The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Longer term, my concern is if the government sucks in more and more of America's savings, there are less savings to go around for the purchase of equities or property or something else. That's something I wrote several years ago now called The Great Reset, about what happens when foreign central bankers aren't there to fund the US government. It will be funded. It doesn't have to be a particularly high interest rate, but it should come at the expense of the valuation of other assets.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Finally, we've got Russell Napier back. We talked about that last week, and sure enough, today's the interview.
I enjoy reading his research and have learned a lot. I mean, going back to a number of years ago when he put together probably one of the most important books in my financial library, which is The Anatomy of the Bear. That, to me, Lessons from Wall Street's Four Great Bottoms, that is a must-read. And I think if anyone's interested in financial history, without knowing it, you owe Russell Napier a great debt of gratitude because of the time, energy, and effort that he put into the research and compilation of facts and figures and insights in The Anatomy of the Bear.
He does not idly call himself a financial historian. This is a man who put in hours and hours, weeks, months, years of study to write that single book. In fact, you could save half a lifetime of study just simply reading the book. And I don't say that about many books, but this was one of the books that did that.
Now, on a routine basis, The Solid Ground, his quarterly newsletter, comes out. I like to read it, and it's not one that is going to be accessible to many, mainly because of the price tag.
Are you sure we couldn't get a discount from him? I mean, I know it's $15,000 a year to read Solid Ground, his quarterly report.
Well, multiply that 15,000 times 1.21, because that's the current exchange rate to pounds. It's 15,000 pounds.
Ah, there you go.
Dollars. Yeah. But an invaluable resource all the same. And the insights he brings and the courses that he teaches at the Edinburgh Business School, which I've taken the time to attend, and the things that he writes periodically, I'm hoping that he writes another book. I don't know what the encore performance is actually for The Anatomy of the Bear, but you can order that online, and I would encourage you to. If you are interested in financial history, it is a must-read.
Well, and David, his charity, The Library of Mistakes, that he has there in Edinburgh, I love the title because the older I get, the more I realize I'm accumulating a library of mistakes. I'm learning.
From your own life experience,
exactly.
Let alone what sets on the shelves, reminding you that these are the lessons that need to be learned and relearned.
Well, and this is an interview that I would recommend people listen to twice, because I know I have to listen two or three times, even after I listen to the interview live. Russell's just a wealth of information.
Russell, some would argue that we have a tectonic shift which is occurring, and that would be away from the deflationary trends that we've had for nearly a decade and towards inflation. You convincingly argue that structural shifts are occurring in the global economy, which are unlikely to be reversed by the Trump administration's fiscal reflation efforts. To start with, you write that global debt to GDP is now at a record high. We've got global debt north of $217 trillion, and the economic engine expected to keep up with that number is about a third its size. While equity investors are celebrating this sort of Trump turnaround, what do you think could go wrong?
Well, there's a very long answer to a very simple question, but I'll just headline the four great big deflationary flaws in the system. And when I put them like that, the listeners need to think about what the US president can do to fix these, because none of them rest inside the United States of America. So that's the first thing to point out. But they are a monetary policy of Japan, which I think will lead to a collapse of the yen. I'll come back to all of these. But when you get an export nation that, when we use the word collapse on its exchange rate, that's a powerful deflationary wave sent around the world. And they have adopted this monetary policy in Japan, which is the most extreme monetary policy by any developed world country, at least since the 1930s. The second one would be an emerging market default, and Turkey, for, don't know to what extent your listeners keep up with what's going on in Turkey, but we could be on the verge of another one of those. In other words, another shock to the financial system because somebody doesn't pay back money that they owe, and we've been through that in recent history, and we know the implications that has for a system. And Turkey actually is a pretty big creditor. It's just shy of $400 billion it owes to the rest of the world. We have the European political situation, which, if there's a political upset in Europe akin to the election of President Trump or akin to Brexit, that is effectively the death of the euro, and I think we know the scale and negative impact of that. We have a Chinese monetary policy which isn't working. It's not fit for purpose to keep trying to manage the currency against the dollar, and I think that will be abandoned in relatively soon now, and they'll try to devalue the currency. And your listeners have already worked out that this gives you the world's strongest currency in the form of the dollar. And when was a very, very strong dollar reflationary, at least for the rest of the world? So here's the question. What can President Trump do about that? You know, the President of America is a powerful man, but these are problems that exist way beyond the control of the United States president.
So looking at those headlines from Japan to the emerging markets to the European political arena and China, all of which are fairly significant, you could tie this into stresses and strains created within the global monetary system. Arguably, the U.S. dollar should correct in the short term. It's had a great run since 2014, but should it continue to strengthen back to, say, the 120 level where we were, say, 15 years ago, at what point would you expect, say, China to float their currency and devalue, or Japan to devalue in earnest? I mean, we're really talking about a domino effect being started off by actions taken here in the United States, which ultimately affect the global monetary system.
I think we have to put these into three groups. One is a decision by a politician to do this as a policy choice. That's the most difficult to forecast because it's a political choice. And that's where China is. China's making that big political decision, and timing on that is notoriously difficult. The other two, actually, particularly Japan, I think it's already happened. I mean, the Japanese voted some time ago for a man who promised them inflation, and he's delivering on that. The reason that I single out Japanese monetary policy as being the extreme one, your listeners will say, well, how could it be more extreme than what we've already seen? Well, here it is. The Fed increased the size of its balance sheet at a rate they told you. The ECB is still increasing its balance sheet at a rate they told you. But the Japanese have decided that it's entirely up to the private sector savers of Japan to dictate the pace and expansion of the balance sheet. They've given a put to all owners of JGBs to sell them as many JGBs as they like at a yield of zero out to 10 years. So the control of the size of that balance sheet is in the hands of the private sector. Now, I think that is the step you need to code a massive devaluation. Now, the yen has fallen somewhat since that decision was taken in September, but I think it's got much, much further to go. So in timing for Japan, we're living through it already. It's already underway. For timing in China, very difficult, not sure, but obviously the more the yen falls, the more that comes to pass. Now, in emerging markets, it's actually much easier again because it's when does the fall in the currency undermine the ability of local corporations to pay back the debt? In other words, when do we get a credit event in the emerging markets? It's nothing to do with a political choice. It's quite literally that someone borrows dollars and can't pay them back. Well, in Turkey, you know, it seems like it could be any day that that's going to happen. And there are some other emerging markets under extreme strain. So in terms of, you know, you asked me the question, I'm not a trader. Is the dollar going to correct for a bit? Perhaps. But in terms of the timing of these things, I think it started in emerging markets and it started in Japan. China, the currency is clearly falling. So I really think we're going to have a very strong dollar, and any correction I would think would be fairly minimal. And just one final point on that, because the reason that dollar gets momentum is it's heavily borrowed by people to finance and finance with cash flows in other currencies. So the thing that makes the dollar different because of that is when it starts to rise, it can produce compulsory purchases. You know, if you and I take a view on the dollar or the yen and we're just using our savings and we get it wrong, no one forces us to change our minds. But if we've borrowed to do it, then we get forced to change our minds because our solvency is questioned. And a dollar bull rally can get a real emphasis and life of its own once you get people compelled to try and pay back the dollar debt. And I think that's begun.
Now, that's happening in the context of a contraction in global trade. That's the backdrop that the Trump administration inherits. So you've got the dollar rising, global economic growth, which is struggling. Is there a connection between these two where we'll actually see, as the dollar rises, further pressure put on global trade and global economic activity?
It is, you're right. It's the absolutely root cause of all of this. I mean, America, from 1991 to 2007, basically when America grew, it produced a bigger current account deficit. In other words, it transferred dollars into the hands of people offshore. And that's not a dangerous situation in which to borrow dollars when they're moving from America offshore. But really, since this current expansion began, which is June 2009, America has failed to produce a larger current account deficit. Shale oil and gas is part of that, David. But I think there's something more fundamental, which is this shift in the consumption patterns of the baby boom generation. They are still consuming, but they tend to shift more to services than goods. And the great current account deficit was built on a baby boom consumption of goods. So there's some structural forces there which mean that America is simply not running these current account deficits. And that takes us to the policies of President Trump. The market is taking this fairly simplistic view that more fiscal stimulus in America means more economic growth, means more imports, means a bigger current account deficit. Well, possibly, but President Trump has other policies which may not produce a bigger current account deficit. And one could obviously think of the oil drilling policy, which, you know, could produce a smaller current account deficit for America if it drills more oil. The tax policy, which would encourage more domestic production and less foreign production. Outright protectionism, which may or may not form part of the new president's policy settings. So global trade is not growing. You know, your listeners can look up the, I think it's called the NPP, which is the Dutch Statistics Board, and they do a wonderful chart of trade volume. The trade numbers get distorted by prices and prices all over the place, but trade volumes are flat on their back already. These policies may or may not flow from the new president. So that's what's strengthening the dollar. Certainly, if there's any slowdown in economic growth in America, that came as a surprise. You could be back at a current account surplus. And the world hasn't had to live with America in a current account surplus since 1991. And the stock markets were a lot lower in 1991. So America's found a new way of growing. The conundrum is to what extent it can be good for America and bad for everybody else. And we can maybe talk about that, but it's certainly bad for everybody else.
That is the point. As the U.S. dollar is appreciating on a relative basis, you're seeing a decline in a number of currencies around the world. So how does that translate? Real goods and services, you could argue, are going up. So we've got a strong dollar here, which may be reflationary in our context, but deflationary on a global basis.
You know, obviously, I think about that a lot. Can America decouple? And one thinks of 1927. I think that's what I think of instantly when I think of this scenario. So in 1927, the rest of the world was not slowing down. It was actually contracting. Prices were falling outside of America. Commodity prices were coming down. Places like Argentina were in trouble. You know, Kingdom got itself into trouble. Your listeners will know the United States was absolute boom time from 27 to 29. And it was kind of for the same reasons, a slightly different mechanism. But all the capital in the world wanted to be in America. And it did go to America. Whether it was directly participating in equities or actually lending money to people, very high interest rates, to buy equities on margin. And that drained capital from elsewhere. It produced a tightening of liquidity elsewhere, but a loosening of liquidity in America. Now, one could say that could happen again, but I think there is a difference this time. And when that happened in 27, the currencies were linked together. So a capital flow to the United States created more money in the United States, didn't push up the dollar was linked to gold. This time, however, it does clearly affect the dollar exchange rate. So, you know, when I sit down and try and weigh all this up, I think it's unlikely, given what's happening with the dollar, that the rest of the world could stay stable as you have a great big American reflation and a boom before that would come back to the United States in some form of crisis outside of the U.S. So it's certainly not impossible that you get a 27 to 29 blow off in U.S. equities. I am not betting my money on that because I look at a highly over-leveraged world with deflationary forces outside and think, could the U.S. equity market just buck that trend if this really begins to roll over badly? My answer to that would be no. But I do have an open mind that it's possible.
Let's go back and talk a little bit more about the current account deficit, because as you say, you know, 1991 is in the rear view a bit, and would be interested in figuring out who gets hurt when the current account shrinks.
Well, 43% of China's current account surplus is with the United States of America. So you don't have to go much further, I think, than China. It already has a capital account deficit, which is a fairly new thing for it, certainly over the last two or three decades. So a country with a shrinking current account surplus and a growing capital account deficit, despite capital controls, is right in the front line of that. And also a country that is managing its currency. I mean, Japan responds to that by just devaluing it as much as it possibly can. But China has this vestigial link to the dollar. So it's China. I mean, there'll be lots of small countries I can mention, but they're not that important. China is the crux of the issue.
So Xi Jinping has some pretty critical policy choices to make. And a part of that is, are we prepared to re-engineer our growth plan moving forward? We've operated on a mercantilist basis for some time to our benefit, keeping something akin to a peg with the dollar. And now the question is it even worth it? Do U.S. demographics keep it interesting for us to remain mercantilist in our orientation? Or do we change completely? And big question mark, can we?
That is right. I think, you know, we have to put it in that stark a term. If you're a fairly small economy and you link yourself to the dollar and you grow, that can work. But when you become the second biggest economy in the world, as they now are, linking your currency to somebody else's is not as sensible. I mean, just how much market share are you going to take? Number one. Number two, global trade's already not growing. And now number three, you have potentially a protectionist president. The policy just doesn't make any sense anymore. So the interesting thing is the obvious policy. I mean, the very obvious policy, and the one that no one will talk about, despite how obvious it is a free float for the renminbi. Because when you're the world's second biggest economy, it's very hard to have anything but a free float. I mean, you have to move towards that. People talk about a devaluation and a repegging, and they just won't talk about a free float. But that's ultimately where China has to end up anyway. A free float with exchange controls, I hasten to add, but a free float nonetheless. Now, if that is the policy that China goes to, which, and the beauty of a free float is it means you just determine your own interest rates based on your own economic conditions. There's no fetter, no restriction on your ability to put interest rates where you want them to be. So you could use them to engineer a great big consumer boom if you wanted, and there'll be no restriction on that. That's where China will go to, but that will be the biggest shock of all. But it's a very nice thing to do for China because they're clearly not currency manipulators. They're clearly not manipulating a currency if, you know, because you're just following, you're growing up. And you're following the same monetary policy that the United States of America follows, which is to set interest rates for domestic economic conditions and let the exchange rate find its own level. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that there wouldn't be political problems if the renminbi collapses, but you can genuinely say you're not a currency manipulator if that's the business you're in, and you're not really doing anything much different than what the United States did from 2007 to 2009. So, as I said, very difficult to get the timing right on a political decision, particularly when it's effectively the political decision of one individual. But that decision is getting closer and closer, and putting more elements in the basket, widening the bands, these are all steps in the same direction. And the direction is a free float for the renminbi. I think it goes down a lot, and that's deflationary once again, initially at least, and not inflationary.
Do you think perhaps one of the things that keeps them from moving to a free float is sort of an insecurity relating to losing control and being in charge of determining a course? I mean, borrowing from the command and control dynamics, which have existed there for a long time, been lessened to a certain degree, but still, it's almost like a security blanket. Do we let go? Do we really move towards a freer market? Is that a concern, or is it, again, maybe perhaps in the realm of politics?
No, that is absolutely correct. I mean, what does the Chinese Communist Party believe in? That's a great question, you know, because it certainly doesn't believe in communism, that's for sure. But it believes in control. That's what it believes in. It believes in political control, and to have political control, they have to have these other controls. So that is the delaying factor. But I would just stress again, this is not a free float without exchange control. This is a free float with exchange controls. So there is still some form of control, but you're right, the thing that holds this back is that the Communist Party is a bizarre thing. But how can you have a market economy run by a party that likes to control? That's what people who talk about China as a free market, how on earth could it be a free market run by a party that likes to control? So we'll see. You know, it could be forced upon them. A very weak yen could force it upon them. A spike in domestic interest rates forced by large capital outflow could force it upon them. But you really hit the nail on the head. And also why it's so difficult to forecast the timing for this is this is a party that likes to control, and you're asking it to give up at least some control, and that's a difficult step for them to take. Particularly this president, I should say. I mean, other presidents of China have been prepared to move a little bit quicker. I think this one is much more control-oriented.
The other party significant to budget deficit, if we're running a deficit here and it shows up as a surplus there, if we should diminish our budget deficit, what does that mean in terms of being able to finance our current spending deficit? We are still needing to borrow a pretty significant amount of money each year. I mean, between a half a trillion and $1 trillion, depending on the year. And it seems like the budget deficit is something that still has to be addressed if we allow the trade deficit to go away.
Yeah. So, I mean, funding the budget deficit, well, the advantage you have is you have a very large domestic savings system. And that large domestic savings system is not heavily committed to your own treasury market. You might ask why. It's for the reason you've pointed out that a lot of your treasury market's owned by foreigners and foreign central bankers. Now, they have already disappeared as a buyer. And up until about 2 years ago, you could have said, well, actually, it's only because the Fed is a buyer that yields are staying relatively low. But then the Fed went away. So the Fed went away as a buyer of treasuries. The foreign central bankers went away as a buyer of treasuries. In fact, they've turned into a net seller of treasuries. Well, treasury yields didn't go spiking up because your domestic savings system was capable, I think aided quite a bit by the Japanese savings system, you know, a private sector choice, not a central bank choice, It should come to the detriment of other assets, of course. The savings system should be liquidating other assets to buy these treasuries. And that's long been my fear, that if the American people had to fund their own government, then there's a lot less capital around to fund everything else. But at least in the early stages of this, it hasn't had that. Maybe we're beginning to see that now in the last 2 months, but at least in the early stages of this, the American government is adequately funded by its own domestic saver in the absence of foreigners. Longer term, my concern is if the government sucks in more and more of America's savings, there are less savings to go around for the purchase of equities or property or something else. That's something I wrote several years ago now called The Great Reset, about what happens when foreign central bankers aren't there to fund the U.S. government. It will be funded. It doesn't have to be a particularly high interest rate, but it should come at the expense of the valuation of other assets.
Two things come to mind. One is a conversation with Carmen Reinhart a few months ago, where she described the corralling of assets and the creating of captive audiences. And last year, of course, we had a change in rules that affects money market funds, where you have a free float for the shares of money market funds that are not treasury backed, and a guaranteed $1 per share valuation for those that are treasury backed. So, of course, we had a massive flow out of money market funds that were in corporate paper and commercial paper and things like that into treasuries. In a classic example of creating a captive audience. If there's plenty of treasury buyers, just change the incentive structure, and whether with carrot or stick, you can move people in the direction of treasuries. But this is the second point, and perhaps the critical and dangerous one. Bill Gross this last week suggested if the 10-year treasury breaks above 2.6%, to him, it signals the end of a bull market in treasuries, which goes back over 30 years, and the beginning of a bear market. Is the domestic savings pool here in the United States, is our domestic savings system really that inclined to be buying treasuries as we head into a bear market? Or would they justify it just on the basis of chasing yield, not looking at capital losses, but saying, hey, it's not 2.5% anymore, it's 3 or it's 4. I just want more income. How do you think that gets sussed out by the average investor?
Well, Carmen Reinhart is now the world's expert on financial repression. And you and I have talked about that in the past. And as you said, what is financial repression? If the savers of America won't fund the government at the price the government wants to be funded at, the government can force savers to do that. That's what financial repression is. And it ran for most of the post-World War II period, so it's not a new thing. It's been done before. It wasn't as aggressive in America as it was in the United Kingdom, because we started with much higher debt after World War II. But, you know, that's a policy which has been done before. It would be a policy which has been done again. Now, you've pointed out one way in which it's already being done. There are others, of course. Under the Basel rules, the banks have to hold more liquid, high-quality assets. But guess what? Treasuries. The new asset liability modeling for insurance companies also forces them to hold, guess what? More treasuries. This is not accidental. You know, I say this over and over again, but you will never hear a government announce a policy of financial repression. It's a bit like, you know, a burglar breaking into your house playing the trumpet. But it's there. It's coordinated. It's for a reason. And I know this because I've done speeches on it. And, you know, I've had central bankers come up to me afterwards and say, well, if you don't believe in financial repression, have you got any other bright ideas? You know, how on earth else are we going to do it? So you're right. The yield is going up. It could go up further. You know, as someone who can see these great deflationary forces breaking out globally, I don't think it's going to go up that much, but, you know, short-term rates in America could go up, the yield could go up. If there was a so-called buyer strike, and briefly here in the United Kingdom in 1976, we had what was known as the buyer strike on government debt. You can force it. It can be forced upon the savings system of America. And I think it absolutely will, and it already is. So the kind of the noose around private capital's neck would tighten pretty significantly if there was a big spike in yields and those yields would be brought down. Remember, the ultimate aim of financial repression is to keep a yield curve below inflation for a very prolonged period of time. And no free market in government paper is going to keep a yield below inflation for a prolonged period of time. So it's going to have to be government enforced. And it's not been necessary to be too aggressive yet, but if it has to be aggressive, then they'll certainly do it. I'm sure you'll be delighted to hear the number one go-to asset when that happens is gold, because that's your protection in an environment like that. So it's going to happen. It's happening. It could ratchet up pretty aggressively if there was a big spike in yields that you've discussed there.
Well, we have some time on the U.S. side, but we're running out of time. If we can pivot to Europe and say that actually the same kind of thing has to be done in Europe. We've got political stress, which is increasing. And really the linchpin is the German central bank. And they've got to be able to make some sacrifices, some compromises, which may go against sort of deep held philosophical views in order to keep things together. Maybe it's not the central bank. Is it Angela Merkel and political sacrifice that's on the table? Which of the two is more important to sustaining the euro project?
Yeah, I think the central bank, you know, of Germany, that's kind of gone now. I mean, the ECB has done so many things that, I mean, I know the Constitutional Court says it's not in breach of its mandate, but look, you know, lawyers are lawyers. They'll always find a reason why you haven't broken something. But in terms of all the safeguards, well, not all of them, but most of the safeguards that effectively the German central bank put in the constitution of the European Central Bank, they've busted through those already. So that's gone. The sacrifice now is a political sacrifice by Mrs. Merkel and by the German establishment, because they are going to have to live with much, much higher inflation in Germany if they're going to help inflate away the debts of the whole of Europe. Now, we will see. We know the historical reasons why the people of Germany are particularly afraid of that particular dynamic, and we'll just see to what extent there is a revolt against that. I mean, inflation is 1.7% in Germany. It's not yet a live issue, but inflation is probably going to go up in Germany. And it might become a live issue. So the person who has to make the sacrifice now is Mrs. Merkel. Now, she'll get elected. It seems dangerous these days to say that anybody will get elected. She'll get elected, and then maybe she'll make that sacrifice. Because to hold the euro together, they're going to have to endorse higher inflation. And maybe elected with another long term in front of her, she simply endorses that. Because without it, I think the risk is there won't be a euro. It may not work anyway. I mean, we may already be too late, given the popular revolt against the federalization of Europe that the euro imposes, not the European Union, but that the euro imposes. It may be too late anyway. So it's difficult to see her making that sacrifice before the election. But maybe she gets elected. Maybe that is what Germany can do, that in German political terms, a great sacrifice.
So correct me here. The likely European step sequence is something like this. Tightening monetary policy leads to slowing growth, causing socioeconomic strain and pressure on the EMU, stirring the political will to abandon the monetary experiment, which would exaggerate disinflation as sort of monetary dissolution in the Eurozone moves into play, leading to sort of the final stage, which would be independence amongst the member countries and the latitude gained to inflate away the debt. Or Germany can make the decision to inflate away. But one way or the other, you're talking about the necessary step forward is inflating away the debt. They've already said no to austerity in one way or another, or at least the people are beginning to say no more. You can risk ruining the financial markets through default of one sort or another, but it really leaves your options limited. It's either inflate on an individual country basis or inflate driven by Germany.
Yep. I think that's a very accurate summary of the situation. There are other ways to bring down your debt, but they're not politically acceptable. Default, austerity, not politically acceptable. In any democracy, inflation's always been the one. And you either Germany provides it, or everyone's going to have to go and create it themselves outside the Eurozone. I mean, and there's a bigger issue in the Eurozone as well. The Eurozone is enforcing a Federated States of Europe, the destruction of the sovereign state. You know, a lot of people within Europe kind of like the sovereign state. They like the European Union, but they like the sovereign state as well. So that means nice compromises to say, yeah, we want to stay in the European Union, but we don't want to be in the euro. And that way you can kind of go back a little bit more towards a common market. And, you know, so we look at it, you and I look at it because of what we do for a living as a financial conundrum. But there is actually a bigger layer on top of that. And, you know, it's not one you're unfamiliar with in the United States of America in attempting to create a federated states. And it didn't work, obviously, in America. It shattered pretty horrifically in the mid-19th century. And I'm not suggesting that it'll be that form of shattering in Europe. But trying to subsume states into a federal system is never easy. And I would argue that your states were significantly more homogeneous than the states of Europe. So above the mere financial and the inflation and all that stuff, there's actually a bigger issue. I don't think the sovereign states of Europe are finished yet. I think the federated states of Europe will never come to pass.
Well, if you're right, and we have, because of a number of potential triggers, whether it is China, Japan, the Eurozone, price deflation, and if that's to be expected, scared money tends to flow to places it views as a safe haven, whether that's US dollar, US treasuries, even to gold. And it, I guess it depends on why it is scared, of course. For most people, the idea of an appreciating dollar is antithetical to a rise in the price of gold. Yet you seem to think that dollars, treasuries, and gold work in the time frame ahead. I wonder if you could look at that and say, well, what are some of the assumptions which ordinarily would cast a pall on gold in a rising dollar environment?
Absolutely. I mean, gold is a function, nothing's a perfect correlation, but it's kind of related to real interest rates. And if I'm telling you that we're going to have deflation, real interest rates are going up, which has been bad for gold. So how can I sit here and say that, you know, this time it's different, this time it's going to be good for gold? I find it easier to say because of where we are with policy settings. I think, you know, anybody listening to this will know that the mistake to be made in the last 7 years was looking at the economy and not looking at the reaction to the economy. You know, and that's the thing that you had to get right to make some money. It was the reaction of policymakers. Now, if we look at a move to deflation or a recession or whatever, where does policy go next? The ball is firmly in the court of the government and not the central bank. The central bank has done an awful lot and is fairly limited now in what it can do from here. And I just think the more you move towards more and more action by government, the more people begin to move to gold. Now, if I put that in the starkest terms, it can sound overdramatic, but there's a rule of man and there's a rule of law. And in a rule of law, you can kind of invest in anything. All assets are safe. There's no government diktat to dictate the returns on those assets or dictate the necessary ownership of those assets. But as you begin to shift towards a rule of man, there is more capriciousness in the system. Capriciousness is uncertainty, and uncertainty, all these things play into the hand of gold. Now, I'm not, you know, one of those people who's throwing their hands up in horror about the election of the president and getting upset about all these things. You have a very, very strong constitution, and we have a very strong constitution in the United Kingdom, and everything is going to be fine. But there are plenty of places in the world, whether it's Turkey or China, where the rule of man is shooting up and the rule of law is collapsing. It may be Poland or Hungary. The rule of man is going up and the rule of law is coming down. And when that happens, that's when people, whether they're Chinese or Turks or Poles or Hungarians, will start to move to gold. And, you know, maybe I'm wrong about the US and Britain, and we'll get more of rule of man and not rule by law. But and if that happens, then gold does even better. So the more you have the capricious whim of government dictating the returns on capital, the more that will be to the benefit of gold.
It's interesting. I mean, you took that in a direction I did not anticipate, because I would have probably replayed something of a 2008-2009 market reaction, which was, wait a minute, we've got way too much counterparty exposure in the context of deflating asset values. We don't know who survives, and we want to have a financial asset that's outside of the financial system. I like that contrast between the rule of man and the rule of law.
So first of all, that's true, and that obviously helps gold. But there's an even bigger level now coming in, which is central bankers could try and do all the hard work the last time. You know, this time it has to be government. The impact for gold is even bigger this time, because there's this new layer involved as well as the one you've just mentioned.
So it's driven not only by concerns of counterparty, but ultimately concerns of the larger context, not just the institution financial, but the institution, as you say, political. Are we safe according to the rule of law? Are we safe according to what we see in terms of the capricious nature of government?
Yeah, and any society where you don't have great faith in ownership rights tends to hold a lot of gold.
Well, we look at that as an issue in India today, and one of the largest consumers of gold, and you've got moves this year by the government to contain the cash in the system, take out dirty money, try to clean up the system, et cetera, et cetera. And some reports even of a move against or limitation of how much gold you can own. How does the individual suss that out? I mean, I'm not asking you to be in Mumbai and speculate what are your choices moving forward. But we exist in the West where, yes, we have a constitution in the United States, you do in the UK, which we've been able to rely upon for a good long time. But there are lots of places in the world that don't have that same kind of social construct, and instinctively respond to gold or just getting out of the system, or at least out of the way of government, because there's more of an existential threat. Is that just a second or third world problem, or could that ever migrate into a first world problem?
I don't think it will migrate into a first world problem. Financial repression, of course, is a way of stealing money kind of surreptitiously. So I'm sure anybody who's listening to this say, well, you know, financial repression is just a surreptitious way of doing it, and to some extent that's right. But, you know, the really bad ones are the overt ways of doing it. I'm not so worried about India. You know, I think that was a move that they made. They have a reasonably strong constitution as well. it'll go in the right direction. But here's the crux of the issue. What we saw in 2016 was certain systems, and I picked the United Kingdom and the United States, bending. That's positive. It's not negative. We've just had this massive constitutional bending in the United Kingdom. You're going to get a new president in America working within the Constitution. That's a system that bends. I think you're absolutely right to look around the rest of the world and say these forces that we see now extant and working, whatever you want to call them, whether they're anti-globalization or anti-elite or anti-capitalist, whatever they are, who can't bend? Who breaks? Who shatters? Now, Turkey, as far as I'm concerned, has already shattered. Hungary has already shattered. And what I mean by shattering is the democratic institutions, or whatever level they were at, they're sliding back towards less democratic institutions. And capitalists need those institutions. They need, in my opinion, I agree that not everybody agrees with this, but the fundamental basis of capitalism is property rights. And the more you have a rule by man and not rule by law, the more capricious those property rights get, the more difficult it is to want to get involved in that. So systems are breaking. They are already broken all around the world, and more of them will break. And we shouldn't be getting pessimistic about the United States and the United Kingdom because they're bending. And the euro is the biggest one of all that might break. Because what is it? It's a new constitution imposed upon the sovereign states. It's nascent, but it's brittle, and it might break. And you should be much more worried about the things that break than the things that bend. You raise the issue of the breakup of the euro and what would happen. Cannot be forecasted. We don't know. But I would say this, the idea that they have to move towards that because the people demand it, and they would permit the free movement of capital as they move to a breakup of the euro seems to be highly unlikely indeed. So one of the fundamental laws that could break would be the free movement of capital. If Europe ever gets to the dissolution of the insoluble currency union, and that's not going to happen in the United Kingdom or the United States. I mean, years from now, in an extreme situation, it could. So let's look at the fragile systems in the world and be more wary about them than the systems that can bend and adjust.
So returning to the credit markets, what do you think the odds are of major credit events occurring in the next 12, 24, 36 months, significant credit events?
Yeah, so people will say that Turkey isn't significant, but from memory, they've borrowed $380 billion worth of foreign currency. So some of that's euro and some of it's dollars, basically. But $380 billion, I mean, let's try to put something in the context. The on-balance sheet liabilities of Lehman's, the day it went bust, were $600 billion. It was obviously, you know, had a lot of off-balance sheet liabilities as well. But so $380 billion is not an insignificant amount of money, but it's clearly not the scale of Lehman Brothers. But I think it does spread around the emerging markets. There are other emerging markets that are vulnerable as well. So the chances of a Turkish one, I mean, it does seem imminent, a Turkish one, given how far the exchange rate has moved, the ability to pay back that foreign currency debt is collapsing. So that one is imminent, but not within 18 months, could be within 18 days.
But you're talking about, you know, again, who has that exposure? There's a lot of that $380 billion that is sitting in European banks, which are not exactly healthy to begin with. So when you see one domino fall, it's not in isolation. It's how that relates to everything else that it's connected to in an interconnected financial world. So you can say, well, Turkey, who cares? But the bigger issue is that may be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of the Eurozone, because you've got tremendous pressure already building in their banking sector.
Yeah, you're right on that. I think one of the interesting things about this emerging market debt crisis, if and when it comes, is for the first time in modern history, the American banks wouldn't be at the front of it. In fact, you know, it's always dubious the data you get, but on the data you get, it does seem that the American banks aren't exposed, that they've been, I mean, I don't want to use, I mean, this will sound ridiculous calling them prudent, but it does appear that they may have been prudent on this occasion. It falls upon the European banks, and it falls upon bondholders, because there's a whole new level of, post-2009, a whole new level of bondholders, and now those bondholders are savers. Maybe actually some of your listeners who have been juicing up their yield in these emerging market bond funds, and they pay a price. But in terms of banks, it is the European banks, and I think it spreads to other emerging markets. So I've got this problem with emerging markets. I sit down all the time with people who buy emerging market debt, and they tell me about the ability to pay, that they have spreadsheets that show there's an ability to pay. Now, that spreadsheet goes the wrong way, obviously, as their domestic exchange rate falls. And I say to them, well, what about the willingness to pay? And you kind of get a blank stare, because anybody who's been to business school knows that spreadsheets don't lie. But spreadsheets do lie, because sometimes people decide not to pay you. And that's the history of emerging markets. You know, the number, the Reinhard and Rogoff book, this time it's different. The number one indicator for a country that's going to default on its foreign currency debt is a country that has defaulted on its foreign currency debt. They decide that the socio-economic pain of paying back, i.e. running a large current account surplus, and maybe liquidating local assets and passing them into the hands of foreigners, these two things, they conclude, are too painful, cannot be borne, and it's easier just not to pay back your foreign currency debt. It's not in the spreadsheets. The spreadsheets show an ability to pay. They don't focus on the willingness to pay. So if Turkey, for instance, does this, I think people will sit down and they will reassess the whole emerging market risk. You know, the book this time is different. It does focus on all these greedy AM booms. And the ironic thing is it was published just as a whole new one began for the same reason. The business school educated analyst says these guys can pay us back. Therefore, they will pay us back. So there's a big shock coming when even one of them, particularly because it's a big one in terms of it, what amount of money it owes, suddenly says that it can't pay you back. I may be the corporation in Turkey who is currently capable of paying back my US dollar debt, but I'm incapable of doing that the day they introduce exchange controls, which is, I think, where Turkey's going to. So a big reassessment of what an emerging market risk is does have impacts beyond that $380 billion, and as you say, does have very direct impacts upon the European banking system.
So we look at 2017, and there's some positive things, as you say, developing in the US and the UK. The systems are bending. They're not breaking. They're not in the context of shattering. There's heightened risks elsewhere, highlighted in your most recent report, looking at China, Japan, the Eurozone. I recall a conversation with Andrew Smithers, actually in Edinburgh, and I had seen you just the day before, and Mr. Smithers said, I'm happy to be in cash right now. I don't need to take risks. A part of that is a function of my age, but a part of that also is a function of my analysis, which says that things are priced for perfection, and I don't know that that's what we're going to have over the next few years. Valuations are getting rich. Now, the interesting thing is that Russell, since then, of course, prices have gone up, valuations have moved to greater extremes, and being in cash, if you're measuring success by opportunity cost, this was an utter failure. How would you view cash as an allocation today, and what is sort of the ideal, I realize not taking into account individual investor needs and profiles, but for Russell, just as I asked Mr. Smithers, for Russell Napier, what is kind of the ideal allocation looking at both a mix of crisis and opportunity in the 2017-2018 timeframe?
Well, David, I've got some news for you. I don't know about Andrew, but I know that I've been sitting in cash, and I've made a fortune by sitting in cash because I'm sitting in your cash. I'm sitting in the mighty dollar. But actually, my return as a returning investor has been pretty spectacular, holding cash, albeit that I chose the right cash. Now, I realize most of your listeners are in the United States, and that maybe isn't so germane, but to say that cash per se is not a good return is not being correct if you chose the right one. So if the mighty dollar is going to continue to rise, it's making all those other assets that are getting cheaper and cheaper for your listeners. And one day, you know, if the dollar does continue to rise, they'll be able to buy them particularly cheaply. I think I agree with Andrew very much on the issue of cash. I think cash is a very important asset for investors. Why is it constantly played down? Because obviously in the very long run, it is a dreadful asset to own in the long run, because we live in a modern world, a democratic world where inflation is inevitably going to get you eventually. I mean, clearly cash is not a good asset to own in that. So that's the first reason it's a bad one. But I'll tell you the second one, it's a bad one, and people don't like to talk about this. But when you go to see a professional fund manager, he can't charge you for managing cash. So of course he's going to tell you that you have to be in all these other things, because he's never going to tell you 30% cash, because you're going to say, well, why should I pay you a fee for managing cash? So I think there's an institutional bias against cash, number one. It is correct to say its long-term return characteristics are dreadful compared to equities, but the word that's used with it, and I think accurately, is optionality. It's there to buy stuff when it's cheap. So, you know, I'm a financial historian. I spent a lot of time reading about people who made a lot of money in markets. And certainly if we go back to the 19th century into the early 20th century and look at the great success stories in the United States of America, whether it's John D. Rockefeller or Andrew Mellon or Carnegie or J.P. Morgan, not the secret of all of their success, but a significant portion of it was either having cash when things were cheap, or having the credit quality to borrow when things were cheap. Now, we haven't really been so much rewarded for that post-World War II in a world of inflation. We haven't had really crushing recessions. But, you know, 82 was a crushing recession. And if you're able to access cash and put it to work, fantastic. What a huge amount of money you made. So cash, I think, is unfairly maligned. You haven't lost a lot of money from owning it because inflation has been somewhat subdued, maybe not as low as reported, but somewhat subdued. You have been losing money, but not a huge amount. And I think it is worth holding on to it for that optionality. The bad news I have for American listeners is it's very hard for me to recommend a currency that you could hold it in that I think would go up against the dollar, because I think the dollar is in such a strong position. So for me, I'm a bit younger than Andrew, but I also like to own cash because I think it gives me optionality to buy things when they're cheap. And it's very, very hard to argue that equities or bonds are cheap. That's the bottom line. The one reason for owning cash is because you argue that both equities and bonds are overvalued. And that's the reason for owning cash. And that's why I continue to own it.
As a value investor, you made a play a number of years ago, perhaps one of the greatest plays that can be made, and that is in knowledge. You invested in the Library of Mistakes, and that is a 3,500 volume, or maybe more now, library, which looks at the history of the markets, the things that have gone right, the things that have gone wrong. And I would venture to say that there are treasures within that library of incalculable value. And interestingly enough, you built that library for pennies on the dollar. So from a value perspective, what you put in and what you ultimately gain, I look at that as one of your greatest investments over the last 15 years, and very intrigued by what you've done with that. May in fact have to start one of those ourselves, so with your permission.
Absolutely. I think I stole that one from Charlie Munger. I think it's Charlie Munger, he says the best investment you can make is to read a book. So if it's good enough for the world's smartest lawyer, it's certainly good enough for me.
Well, great to have you on the program again. It's been a little while, and I look forward to being in the UK, perhaps late this summer, and our paths crossing again. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot. Cheers.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Russell Napier. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.